All right, joining us at this point is our old friend Dr. Tony Held from UCD. Well, formerly from UCD.
Well, still sort of with UCD. I work as a postdoctoral researcher.
Dr. Held, you have brought me several volumes of reading, which have kind of blown me away slightly.
Well, this is going to sound like a relentless plug, but there's a collection of books by the Bathroom Readers Institute.
Of course, a well-known and distinguished organization.
Exactly. I think they're out of the Berkeley or somewhere in the Bay Area. Uh-huh. But basically, the thrust of these books are they're a collection of stories ideal for the reading room of the house, which, of course, is the toilet.
Right.
And they've got stories categorized as short stories or quick stays, long stays, and then the...
And nothing in here seems to go past three pages.
That's right. Although right. They do have a section in some of the later books called the Leg Number series, in case you're going to be there so long that you know you need at least 10 pages to get you by. Most of the stories are kind of bizarre, in a sense, that you're going to learn something that you hadn't thought of before.
It just has this show's name all over it.
Yeah, I mean. It does. Like, there's one Scottish sport called ferreting. Right. Uh-huh. I don't know if you read that.
I don't know that one. What is ferreting?
And so basically, it's a rite of manhood to take a very surly ferret, right? Have it crawl up your leg.
Ferrets are not noted for being particularly.
They're not your favorite, like lap pets, right? And what you do is you have a drawstring on your pants, right? Uh-huh. And you cinch it as tight as it'll go.
Uh-huh.
And then you have no underpants on.
Uh-huh.
And you have your other ankle cinched. You have the ferret run up the one ankle. Uh-huh. You cinch that. And then the ferret, you know, is decidedly unhappy about this closed quarters.
Uh-huh.
And then the most manly or unintelligent person.
I'd say some. Anyone who's willing to put an angry ferret in their pants deserves whatever happens to them.
Okay. So, and then it's whoever can stand the longest. And you would think seconds, right?
Holy.
But the record or like minutes, and they wear like these, you know, like industrial pants to try to hold them in there because they're clawing around for their life. And
that's so horrible.
It's horrible for all involved. Luckily, the ferret doesn't have anything other than the stink, you know, as a remembrance of it. You know, they don't hurt the animal or anything. But anyone who would do this is like, oh yeah, that'll prove that I'm a bright fellow.
Well, now that we piqued the interest of the listener.
So, I mean, it's just rare that you pick up a trade magazine or the newspaper and they tell you about ferreting.
Oh, my. Well, you know, here's one actually that I thought was really memorable. Inside Jeopardy. It tells the story of how Merv Griffin in 1963 was on a plane with his then wife flying around. After the quiz show scandals of the 50s, they decided we ought to have a quiz show that has the answers. That way we can't be accused of giving people the answers. We give them the answers. They have to come up with the question. And they were sort of batting it back and forth. And at this point, his wife asked him what was to be, what history would record as the very first Jeopardy answer. This is a true test of our listeners, I think, trivia knowledge. She asked him, 79 Wistful Vista. To which Merv replied, what's Fibber McGee and Molly's address? That's something for the old-time radio fans.
Not the new ones. That's an obscure reference.
It is. It's very obscure, but old. Yeah. I actually got that one because I'd listened to some of these old CDs of old time radio, and by God, there it was. Another one, 1313 Mockingbird Lane.
It's where Gregory Peck is hanging out.
Ah, the Munsters.
Oh, the Munsters.
That's more for your generation. Actually, we're not even getting close to your generation. But the one that I really wanted you to talk about here, which is, I think, sort of on a more serious note to some degree here, the Bathroom Reader tells a story about little Naida, and the story goes dated Dateline October 10th, 1990. Little Naida testified before a televised congressional hearing. Quietly sobbing at times, the teenage girl from Kuwait told how she had watched Iraqi troops storm a Kuwait city hospital, snatch 15 infants from their incubators, and leave the babies to die on the cold floor. Americans were appalled. People across the country joined President Bush in citing the story as a good reason why Americans should go to war.
Yeah, it's funny you bring this up because I just saw HBO special, The Bombing of Baghdad or something to that effect, which was a documentary on the CNN's involvement.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of a centerpiece.
Oh, this was a huge story at the time. This is 12 years ago. It really got the nation in a mood to go take care of Saddam once and for all and get rid of this dictator who's now still in power, conveniently a man that we need to go out there and do something about to get rid of.
Couldn't get him the first time.
Yeah, for some reason, the whole U.S. Army couldn't be sent the 4 hours up the Basra Highway to take care of him, and we had to keep him in power. But, of course, his story was a lie. Little Naira turned out to be the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. This incident never took place. She was told how to tell this story before Congress for maximum benefit before the U.S. public, and she told this whopper, achieving the ends of those who put her up to it.
Yeah, there's a famous quote, you know, people are more likely to believe a big lie than a little lie.
Naira had actually been coached as to what to say by Hill and Knowlton, one of America's most distinguished public relations firm, headed by President Bush's former chief of staff, Craig Fuller. I believe Hill and Knowlton are the same people that brought us Smokers' Rights, a grassroots effort to promote civil rights among people who would like to smoke cigarettes anytime, any place. Yeah, it's quite a story. I mean, it is, I think, relevant today because it's 12 years later, and as I pointed out on this show before, they are looking for something to get us to go in and win over the public, and I expect that sometime the next month or two, we're going to hear some other variation of the theme of Little Naira's story.
The U.S. is just dying for some sort of moral high ground to go in and say, oh, you know, they're, you know, killing infants or something to that extent. So anytime I hear, you know, on the news that, oh, they found weapons in Turkey, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm waiting for the spin of how they're going to turn this into its, you know, terrorist organization and links to Iraq, and now we're going to go bomb the hell out of it. We're waiting for that flashpoint.
I think it's worthwhile to have a bit of skepticism about what we are fed, and I think Little Naira's tale is a prime example of exactly this. Now, 18 pages later in the same book which you've given me, there is a brief summary, one of the best brief summaries I've seen of another parallel in history, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which are you familiar with this?
This probably what started the skirmish in Southeast Asia, perhaps?
It didn't start the skirmish, but it certainly got the ball rolling in a big way. It was August 4th, that is, 1964. President Lyndon Johnson interrupted American television programming on all three networks with grim news. He announced that the American destroyers who were sailing off the coast of North Vietnam in the Gulf of Tonkin had been attacked twice by the North Vietnamese without provocation. He promised reprisals. In fact, he declared that U.S. planes were on their way to bomb North Vietnam as he spoke. 3 days later, Johnson asked Congress to pass an emergency resolution that would authorize him to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. Congress obliged with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution passed 98-2 in the Senate, and Johnson used it to launch us into the longest war in American history.
It seems so straightforward when you put it like that. Yes, when it's packaged in the saran wrap of the government propaganda, it seems like we were just out there making sure fishing ships were okay, and lo and behold, we got attacked for no reason.
Well, your book, which you gave me, points out accurately here, summarizes very well what actually went down, which was that the Maddox wasn't out in international waters. It was 10 miles, possibly as close as 4 miles from the North Vietnamese coast, sailing around on a provocation. It was providing cover for South Vietnamese gunboats attacking North Vietnamese radar stations. So had an attack taken place, it would not have been unprovoked. It would have been really provoked.
If you're armed escort for someone, you're not an observer in international waters.
The fact of the matter is the reports of enemy attack were held to be very doubtful. Commander Jim Stockdale, who a few years back was Ross Perot's vice presidential candidate, at that time was a Navy pilot. He responded to the Maddox's distress call and later noted in the New American Magazine that they were sitting out in the water firing at nothing, no one. No American out there saw any such PT boat, and I saw a later summary of the entire damage done to the United States military vessels was one bullet hole.
Well,
so I think the lesson of the Gulf of Tonkin incident and Little Naira's tale both is that we should be cautious before going off and promoting war.
Yeah, a tremendous amount of independent information that you can cross-reference on another giver other than the government trying to justify their position is in order before you commit a lot of people to killing a lot of other people. Just a couple flashpoint and, you know, moral outrage sort of incidences reported by a couple people shouldn't be enough to sway the amount of damage that could be done as a consequence.
I think you were speaking words of wisdom, and let us pay close attention to what comes out of the news stories in the next couple months.
As seen through the filter of the Bathroom Readers Institute, Uncle John Readers.
Well, I hope not.
I hope we don't have to depend upon Uncle John's
edition to come out 5 years from now, post the war, to decide that it all was a fake, people. Do you want to do some medical and other scientific type myths?
Sure,
I think you're a scientific kind of guy.
Now, you're a medical doctor. I'm not a medical doctor.
We pulled this a list of things that I thought were interesting to perhaps go over here on our show. We love to debunk, as we just did, and let's do some more. What I want to debunk are things you've heard in the realm of science and medicine that aren't true.
Okay, I'm with you.
All right, the first one.
Smoking is good for you.
No.
Okay.
A substance can be added to swimming pools that will turn color in the presence of urine, revealing those who pee in a pool. You've heard this, right? We've all heard this.
I mean, colorimetrics and, you know, those sorts of titration experiments in a lab, it seems entirely reasonable that this is plausible.
Yeah, well, it's not true.
Oh, well.
Because in the amount of volume that constitutes a swimming pool, any substance that could detect urine, I mean, urine is a very dilute substance anyway, the urea in urine, and to dilute it to swimming pool volumes, there is. I mean, it's not to say there isn't something that theoretically couldn't mark urine, or I'm sure we could find something, but something that you could buy commercially, put into a pool and actually light up with enough visible clouding to be detectable by someone looking in the pool, no way! I called up Leslie Poole when I was researching this. They're out on Douglas Boulevard in Roseville, and I said, "And I understand that you have no such commercial product." The guy said, "No, we don't, but I wish we did, because apparently a lot of people would like to put that in their pool."
It terrifies me if you go to people in a hot tub. Everyone jumps in there and is drinking wine and beer, and they never get out. I mean, the inflow-outflow thing terrifies me.
Concept. Yeah.
I mean, you got to get out, right?
Yes. We don't recommend you pee in a pool. but the fact of the matter is, if you're in dire fear of the fact that you'll be mortified, we don't want to go there. No, we're not going to recommend you pee in a pool.
Yeah.
Don't pee in a pool, but you know, you're not going to get busted if you do.
Let it not be said that we endorse urinating in pools.
No, we do not. We do not. Now, the other swimming related myth that I think we should explode. We should just explode this myth for the public.
This will be on Dateline tomorrow night if we do it.
That you must wait 1 hour before swimming to avoid potentially fatal cramps. Now, I remember as a kid being, you know, sitting there by the pool, you've just had a sandwich, and your mom and dad are going, no way, looking at the clock. It's 12 noon, you got till 1 o'clock.
Especially the grandmas and aunts who rigidly adhere to this as if you will detonate if you stick a pinky in the water.
Yeah, I mean, that was a famous cartoon in National Lampoon. I think it was a Gay and Wilson showing a kid going over, putting one toe in the water, doubling over from the severe cramps, racking his body. Well, it's just plain not true.
Yeah,
you can get cramps from vigorous activity, playing baseball, doing some, you know, whatever, so running. But there's nothing about a swimming pool that's going to induce cramps. There's nothing about water that's going to induce cramps. This apparently was put in the 1940s Red Cross manual. And in spite of the fact that the Red Cross now repudiates it and they've done studies and, it, you know, that everyone realizes this is not true, boy, it's out there in the folk wisdom.
Okay, so the question is, let's say you do cramp in the water, right?
Yeah.
You've got this agonizing thigh pain.
Most
right?
of us have done if you've swum or played water polo
okay,
at some point.
Something happens like that, right? Now, will this increase your mass to the point where you're just going to sink to the bottom of the pool?
Like a stone.
And have no chance.
Not only do you cramp, you just go straight to the bottom.
You'll just be a dwarf star, right? And suck everyone with you to the bottom as you plummet towards the core of the earth. Or can you just float, tread water, and say, I'm cramping to someone?
Well, what you do is when you get a bad cramp, as I recall the first time I actually, the first time after like, probably 12 years into this idea of you can't swim until you've had, you know, an hour wait. I actually was playing water polo in high school and got a really nasty calf cramp and got out and walked it off. Got out of the pool and walked it off and went back in. It was not like imminent drowning was a possibility.
There was a David Letterman top 10 list, and it said top 10, you know, signs that you've gone to a bad hospital. And one of them was there's an entire wing of the hospital dedicated to walking off injuries. Okay, so here's the one that I did think was true, right? That stepping on a rusty nail will give you tetanus, or that something bad will become of it. And of course, I realized that this has to be true because on The Simpsons one time, Homer stepped on a nail and had to pry his mouth open with a fork to be able to eat. Well, once the lockjaw set in.
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
Okay.
This one is partly true. You can get tetanus from an organism called Clostridium tetani. It is a bacterium that lives without the presence of oxygen. Oxygen is poisonous to it. It lives in the soil. And if you had a rusty nail that was contaminated by soil with that bacteria on it and you poked yourself with it, the bacteria can remain in the body in a deep puncture wound away from a lot of oxygen, could grow, produce a toxin that can be fatal. It almost never happens in America because of tetanus shots. However, I believe something like 30 or 40,000 people a year succumb in India.
Wow.
To tetanus because of the fact there is not a lot of vaccinations available and some medical practices they have over there that are turned out to be very unhealthy that I won't go into.
It's not that it's a rusty nail per se. It's that you're
exactly
allowing an anaerobic organism into your body through a puncture.
Yes.
That could happen through a rusty nail. So
yes.
Staples
rusty,
are just,
yes.
A staple in the dirt is just as dangerous.
Or a rusty nail that was sitting on a shelf in your house for the past 20 years. If you happen to brush up against it and puncture yourself, you're not going to get tetanus from that. Nevertheless, since it is an easily preventable fatal disease, it probably does make sense to be up to date on your tetanus shots.
Well, and let us also warn, the public that we're not recommending, in addition to urinating in pools, that you do not jab yourself with sharp objects just to disprove or test our theories.
No, and make sure your shots are up to date. All right, you're a man of science. I'm sure you've heard this one. Water drains out of the drain clockwise in the northern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere due to the Coriolis force.
Okay, so the Coriolis force, right? We're on an Earth that's spinning, right?
Yes.
In much the same way, if you were on a record and that was spinning.
Yes.
If you're at the edge of the record, it's spinning faster than the center of the record, right?
Yes.
So in some sense, if you start walking towards the center of the record, you're going to feel some sort of force.
Yes.
You're going to feel some sort of, like things aren't right, I'm getting turned around sensation, right?
Mm-hmm.
In much the same way that's happening on the Earth. And a lot of people notice that, cyclones and hurricanes spin in a certain way in
yes.
one hemisphere versus another, right?
They do.
Well, they definitely do, right?
Yes.
So the thought is that if you're on the other hemisphere, then it'll spin the opposite direction.
Which they do. Ocean currents and like hurricanes.
They definitely do, right?
Yes. The demonstration, and it's extremely dramatic, of the Coriolis force is to go to the playground where they have one of those things that spin, like little merry-go-rounds. Remember, you used to jump on, they'd spin in one direction. The big wheels, in essence. Get onto the wheel, have someone sit in the center, and you sit on the edge, and spin it. Now, as you look at them, pick up a pebble and toss them the pebble. And the when you try this experiment, the most amazing thing takes place. You expect that when you toss the pebble, it will go straight at them. Instead, you toss it and it goes and it makes an unbelievable hard right and disappears off to one side. It's very dramatic.
But what happens in the northern hemisphere, it's always going to turn things to the right, right? That's what happens. It always turns things to the left in the southern hemisphere. And if you're on the equator, since you're moving along the equator, you're on the same spot on the record, in a sense, so it's not going to accelerate one way or the other. But the long and short of it is, there's so many other important factors in flushing a toilet that swamp the effect of the Coriolis force.
Yes,
if
like
you
where
look
the
at
holes
a toilet,
are.
The holes that the jets are directed,
yes.
shooting out water
yes.
in this one way, and that overwhelmingly will swamp. If you had a perfect water basin with, a frictionless surface and a perfect drain that didn't have any, irregularities, then yes, it would spin one way in one hemisphere and another way in the other. But being a fan of empirical evidence, my dad was a navigator on cargo planes, and when they flew from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere, they walked into the toilet, which were pressurized, and they had like a pump system, and they flushed it when they were 100 miles on one side, flushed it over the equator, and flushed it on the other side, and it had no change whatsoever, right?
Well, now there you go. I myself did it, performed an experiment when I was in the third grade, having heard this cockamamie story. And it was my observation that water went down the drain at random, sometimes to the right, sometimes to the left. And I performed the experiment again and again and again, and it's true. There is no dominance of one force. Tony, we're out of time. So you'll have to come back next time when we talk about things like the full moon makes people crazy. But stay tuned now for our third segment coming up after a short break with Jerry Rose as we talk about eclipses and other things. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM.